Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's official. The U.S. government, meaning you, the taxpayer, will soon own part of 9 of the largest banks in the U.S. President Bush today announced plans to directly buy $250 billion worth of shares in the nation's largest financial institutions. The money comes from the $700 billion financial rescue package, and the government is expected to eventually expand the program to buy equity in thousands of U.S. banks. Today, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson said he doesn't like the idea of the U.S. government getting into the banking business, but he had no other choice.
Government owning a stake in any private U.S. company is objectionable to most Americans, me included. Yet the alternative of leaving businesses and consumers without access to financing is totally unacceptable.
Damian Paletta is with the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. And Damian, this is a real reversal for Henry Paulson. He pushed for buying up just bad assets from banks, getting them out of the credit stream. And last month, Paulson told the Senate Banking Committee that the plan he's announced today, buying these good assets in banks, investing, is what you do when you have failure. So, first of all, why his change of heart?
Well, that's right. When they made the sales pitch several weeks ago to Capitol Hill, they were really pumping up the issue of these reverse auctions that were gonna take, you know, strip out the toxic and poisonous assets off bank balance sheets. We're still trying to figure out exactly, you know, when that watershed moment was for them to switch gears. You know, they always did have the power in the bill to invest directly in banks, but we have to think that what happened with the stock market and people starting to really worry about their retirement and their 401k really sent a signal to policymakers that something dramatic really needed to be done. And also, of course, when we saw our foreign counterparts taking these dramatic moves, I think it put a lot of pressure on U.S. policymakers to follow suit.
So tell us, how is this going to work? How do they pick the banks? Because in Britain, where this plan was initiated last week, as you say, they started it first, some banks there said that the government purchase sent a bad signal that they were failing. So how is Paulson going to avoid putting a big target on banks that need help?
Well, it's really kind of tricky. And one of the reasons they had these 9 of the top financial institutions over yesterday to meet with Treasury was for Treasury to say, listen, you know, so I know some of you don't think you need the capital, don't want the capital, but the public needs an injection of confidence. So the idea is, if the money goes directly into these 9 big companies, then other companies that might need the capital but are worried about stepping forward, they won't feel as bad about coming forward to get it. And then eventually, you know, capital will start flowing through the system again and banks will be lending.
Well, and in fact, we understand this meeting was quite remarkable, and that Paulson literally said to these CEOs, you have to take the government stock purchase for the good of the U.S. economy. And some of the banks that are going to do this really aren't in trouble. They're sort of, you know, foils, so that nobody can really guess who the truly failing banks are initially.
That's right. I mean, I think people have a pretty good sense, just, you know, based on, you know, some of the indicators about which banks are in better shape than others. But, you know, clearly, I mean, of course, J.P. Morgan was at this meeting, and they're seen as one of the as performing, you know, possibly the best. Goldman Sachs has been relatively healthy and as well. So, but these really are the 9 of the pillars of the U.S. banking system at this meeting, and the concerns weren't really about these 9 as much as, you know, about the thousands of other banks and financial institutions and other, you know, this affects everyone from those people trying to get student loans and car loans and that sort of thing. So once the capital starts flowing, you know, we have to take this really dramatic step at the beginning. But the idea is that this will get money flowing again. Right. But, of course, this has never been tested. It's unprecedented. So who knows how it'll work.
Well, and by the way, will the banks that participate be further regulated in any way? Will they have to take part in programs restricting CEO pay, for instance?
That's right. They will have to take part in CEO pay restrictions. Actually, it's going to apply probably to the top 5 people at each company for pay restrictions. But also there'll be limits on dividends that the companies can pay to their investors. There's also, you know, we're going to see a lot more oversight. And, of course, next year, Congress, and no matter who is the president, we're going to see just a lot more regulation. They're going to really redraw the playbook for oversight of financial institutions, and so that's all going to be on the table.
And meanwhile, the Federal Reserve announced that they're going to begin buying back some of that bad debt on October 27th, so that program is set. And we should note that President Bush and others have said that the hope is that this money that's being injected in banks will then be sold back to the U.S. government by those banks down the road. We just want to have said that. Damian Poletta of the Wall Street Journal talking to us about the government's new plan to buy shares in 9 of the largest U.S. financial institutions. Damian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, the financial news has pushed a lot of other news off the radar. For instance, Pakistan is at war. 250,000 people have fled full-scale fighting between Pakistan's military and the Taliban in places like Peshawar along the border with Afghanistan. And on Pakistan's other border, India, and recently and for the first time, Congress approved the sale of U.S. nuclear fuel, technology, and reactors to India for peaceful energy use, even though India has not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Well, both of those stories would certainly have received more coverage if not for World Economic News, and both, as everything is in the region, will probably be in some way related. So we wanted to take a look at both of those stories right now. Aisha Lal is professor of history at Tufts University. She was born in Pakistan. She was a MacArthur Foundation Fellow. Her latest book is Partisans of Allah, Jihad in South Asia. And Shugato Bose is professor of history at Harvard University. He grew up in Calcutta, India. His latest book is 100 Horizons, the Indian Ocean in the Age of Global Empire. And they've also published together a general history, Modern South Asia. Who better to turn to get our overview today? Let's start with Aisha. Let's start with Pakistan, too, as we start with you. War on at least 3 fronts in the country's northwest. The conventional thinking was that under Pervez Musharraf, Pakistan talked of fighting militants but didn't. Is it too simplistic to now say that now that Musharraf is gone, Pakistan is taking on the Taliban and al-Qaeda?
Well, there is less of an ambivalence in terms of what is being done in the tribal areas. Certainly in Bajor, there's a full-scale operation underway. The military is involved. There's political backing being given by the civilian government. And what is more, I think for the first time, even the people are clear that this is a war that has to be fought because the threat is to Pakistan. So while there are those still who question whether this is in fact Pakistan's war, I think the ambivalence is far less than it was under Musharraf.
There was the chilling report a couple of weeks ago again. These reports out of Pakistan have been buried a little bit, but a U.S. commander saying that in Bajor, he was stunned by how strong the fighters were.
That's true, and I think we've known that for quite a while, and action has been very slow in coming. And so in that sense, I think something very important is happening or has been happening for the last month and a half.
Well, and let's just switch our sights to the other Pakistan border. I mean, we'll come back to the situation in Pakistan. But Shugato, what, if any, parallel or connection is there to the news last week that the U.S. gave this new nuclear permission to India in a new treaty that would allow people to sell nuclear technology and reactors for peaceful use to India? Is there a connection? Are there dots to be drawn between the fighting on the Afghan border and the deal with India on the other border?
There is at least an indirect connection. India has global ambitions, ambitions of playing a role on the global stage. And for that, it needs a good new strong strategic partnership with the United States. And the Indo-US nuclear agreement is one symbol of that emerging relationship between India and the United States. But at the same time, India has to live in its own neighborhood. It has to have good relations with Pakistan, a stable Pakistan, a Pakistan that is not racked by militancy, is in fact in the long-term interest of India. And India also has to be a part of the other story, which is the economic resurgence of Asia. And for that reason, India needs to keep relations in good repair with China and the rest of Southeast and East Asia, and even Iran, I would say, which is just to the west of both Pakistan and India. So India's global ambitions will be hobbled if, in fact, it does not have a relatively stable, peaceful neighborhood, particularly in terms of its relations with both Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, but given that, it can't possibly be making Pakistanis feel good that India is receiving more nuclear devices from the U.S.? I mean, isn't that something that would unsettle the region?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think the Pakistani official position is that they would like to be treated on par with India as far as the treaty is concerned. But I do think at the same time, this does open a way for Pakistan to continue doing what it has been doing with perhaps greater legitimacy, i.e. with China. Pakistan has been purchasing materials from China. There has been a transfer of technology. The Pakistani nuclear program has a good amount of Chinese input.
What does it mean to India, Aisha, that Pakistan is fighting the Taliban on the Afghan border?
Well, I think it should mean a lot to India because an unstable Pakistan, as Sugata has just pointed out, would be a disaster. On the other hand, Pakistan has been harping on the fact that India is using Afghanistan to promote sedition in Pakistan's Balochistan area. This has been the official charge as well. I do think that there is a knotted relationship here in terms of India's role in Afghanistan and how Pakistan envisages that.
Well, we began by saying that the U.S. has not been paying as much attention because it's preoccupied with the financial crisis. Are people in the region angry about that, you know, given they've now got their hands full, or maybe relieved?
I think there would be some relief because the American attacks on targets located on the Pakistan side of the Pakistan-Afghan border have been making it more difficult for those in Pakistan who want to see this as Pakistan's war. Now, these tribal areas on the northwestern frontiers of Pakistan have never been closely ruled by any imperial or national power in history. And so in some ways, the United States not taking too aggressive a posture would help.
But there's no evidence of the United States not taking too aggressive a posture. I think, if anything, there seems to be an intensification of the operation along the border with Pakistan.
How is that viewed by Pakistanis?
Well, again, I mean, I think the official position is one of disdain and anger, but there is a belief that this couldn't really be done without some nod from the Pakistani military. Even though that's a well-kept secret, if there is an understanding, there is some indication that there could be. But clearly, from a public opinion point of view, the fact that an attack goes and kills women and children is extremely unpopular and counterproductive for what the Pakistani military is trying to achieve there.
And by the way, is it assumed by all observers that the Pakistani military is wholeheartedly into this fight? I mean, we're reading that in some areas, people took it upon themselves, civilians took it upon themselves to organize fighting forces to take on the Taliban because there was a sense that some deep in the military were actually still backing and aiding the Taliban.
Well, I mean, the tribal areas are quite variegated. There are sort of seven tribal agencies, and the situation is different in each one of them. In Bajor, the military is fighting. In others, the military is trying to encourage local inhabitants to rise and fight the Taliban, because it's clear to the military, and this is a point that Sugata was making as well, that the tribal areas have never really been controlled by any government, and so they are fiercely independent, and the best case scenario is for them to fight the Taliban, both Afghan and Pakistani Taliban themselves. So the military is actually involved and is actively encouraging these groups, these tribals, to set up their own lashkars and take on the militants.
That's Aisha Jalal, professor of history at Tufts. We're also speaking with Sugata Bose, professor of history at Harvard. When we come back, what do they think of Barack Obama and John McCain's policies for the region? Also later today, Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, the first and only black and white comedy team. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. And we are back with more from Aisha Jalal and Sugata Bose, two of the most distinguished observers of South Asia. In fact, their jointly published history is Modern South Asia. We've been talking about Pakistan and India, nuclear rivals, and both fighting homegrown and foreign militants. We talked about Pakistan and the Taliban. Let's turn to Kashmir, a province that straddles India and Pakistan. On the Indian side, it is the only province with a Muslim majority, and those Kashmiris are agitating for autonomy. Many want independence. India has several hundred thousand troops in the state. Tens of thousands of civilians have died there in 20 years of violence. And India and Pakistan have fought wars, and their troops continue to exchange sporadic fire across the line of control on this border. Now, you were both in Kashmir this summer. Sugata, you start. What did you see?
Well, the situation has definitely taken a turn for the worse. And on the days that we were there in early August, there was a complete shutdown of the valley. And we saw that the alienation of the people of the Kashmir Valley had taken on alarming proportions. I think what had happened was that the Indian state had misinterpreted superficial calm to be an outright victory. And a problem such as Kashmir has to be addressed. It cannot be evaded. And this can only be done by revising old fixed notions both about sovereignty and about borders.
Revising how?
For example, the Indian Prime Minister began to talk about soft borders. A new bus service started between Srinagar on the Indian side and Muzaffarabad on the Pakistan side. But that was too small a step. One needs to build, cross-border institutions rather than build barbed wire fences, because people are tied through very close, social relationships, something of the sort that has been done in Ireland, for example. It's a problem that is not insoluble. But if you simply make it a zero-sum game, that it's a territorial dispute and this is a piece of real estate that either belongs to India or Pakistan, you can make no headway. Both Ayesha and I have written for a very long time about India and South Asia having historically had a layered and shared concept of sovereignty. So you can have the highest level of sovereignty in New Delhi or Islamabad, but you can concede, some measure of sovereignty at the regional level.
But Ayesha, how hard is that going to be? Because we understand some Indians blame Pakistan for arming and supporting terrorists. They would call them inside Kashmir. Some in India blame their own government for heavy-handed policies. The right wing in India blames the government for being soft on Islamic radicals, and giving too many special rights to Kashmiris. So there's all these other players who have their own interest in keeping the discord.
Oh, yes, I think the conflict in Kashmir suits the interests of many, and that's one of the major problems, that perpetuating the conflict is so convenient. But I will say that while I completely agree that there is a need for renegotiating the union on the basis of a shared and layered sovereignty, I think that these things are difficult to understand and comprehend. But I do think what is quite simple to understand is that people need to live with a sense of dignity. And the Kashmiris, they feel that they are being humiliated by the Indians. And that makes it that much more difficult for people to comprehend or even want to comprehend what Sugato and I have been talking about, a renegotiated union of South Asia, if possible.
And if you are not able to divide sovereignty, you end up dividing territory. You end up dividing land. And sometimes I fear that even those who ought to have a better understanding of these issues call for territorial partitions within Kashmir or, a territorial partition on sectarian lines in Iraq. And however you might want to cut up a piece of territory, you'll always leave vulnerable minorities of one kind or another. That's why it's much better to be able to layer sovereignty, to be able to share power, to be able to cross borders rather than make them frontiers which only terrorists can cross. Let common people be able to cross them. So that's the way in which we need to move. And if I may add, in this election season in the United States, I think Barack Obama needs better advice on Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. He sometimes too rashly talks about sending American forces to take out targets in the tribal areas of Pakistan. And even Joe Biden, who has a wealth of experience, came very close last year to advocating a partitionist solution for Iraq, which, anyone who knows anything about the history of South Asia will know would be a complete disaster.
Do you have any comments on what John McCain has said about the region?
To be honest, I am an Indian citizen, so I don't have a vote here. And if I did have the vote, I would support Obama. Let me make it very clear. But on India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, I actually believe that McCain has a somewhat better grasp of the issues. Even in the debate that I heard, Obama was saying that he wanted to rush into Pakistan and Afghanistan. And he's wanting to do in Pakistan and Afghanistan what has failed in Iraq. I don't see how that kind of a policy might work. But McCain actually made a reference to history, saying that these tribal territories have never been controlled by any imperial power. So,
well, I think the more important thing is that Obama seems to be doing a lot of catching up. Effectively, I don't think that there is much of a difference in the policies being advocated by both sides for Afghanistan and Pakistan. But where Mr. Obama becomes a little shriller and therefore a little off target is in his attempts to try and show himself to be on par with the Republicans in their determination to take out Osama bin Laden and his associates. So I think that's where the balance needs to be struck. We keep hearing that Pakistan needs to do more. Anybody who knows the terrain will know that there is no border to protect. So I think that it's really a question of politics rather than policy, which is, as far as that region is concerned, is what's happening with American, the election debate.
Which is driving the conversation now. That's Aisha Jalal, professor of history at Tufts University. Her latest book is Partisans of Allah, Jihad in South Asia. We've also been speaking to Sugato Bose, professor of history at Harvard University. His latest book is 100 Horizons, The Indian Ocean in the Age of Global Empire. I want to thank you both.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, after the news, how's the banking town of Charlotte, North Carolina, weathering the financial crisis here and now? Before we go today, Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, once America's first and so far only black and white comedy act. But first, if you think Wall Street has been in a tizzy for the past few weeks, consider Tryon Street in Charlotte, North Carolina. At the north end sits the corporate headquarters of Bank of America. At the south end, the worldwide offices of Wachovia Bank. Now, for years, these two banks competed for customers and bragging rights as the city's most generous civic partner. Together, they made Charlotte the nation's second largest banking center after New York. And the city basked and grew in the bank's rivalries. But then, the crisis. Bank of America purchased troubled Merrill Lynch, and as Bank of America's fortunes rose, Wachovia's stock fell 70%. There was a potential merger with Morgan Stanley and a bidding war between West Coast-based Wells Fargo and the East Coast giant Citigroup. Wells Fargo won, and they are now in the process of taking over Wachovia. What does all of this mean for Charlotte? Well, Richard Thurman is the editor of Charlotte Magazine. He joins us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. And Richard, you've covered the city for 13 years. How's it been these past couple of weeks for people there?
It has been the wildest roller coaster ride that I can remember. I never thought I would see a city be so happy to have Wachovia bought as when the Wells Fargo deal went through, because there was a lot of fear about what might happen. First, if Citigroup actually purchased Wachovia, but after that, when they were talking of splitting the bank between Wells and Citi, that was sort of the nightmare scenario for Charlotte. So being purchased by Wells is a bit of a relief for us.
Well, the former editor of your magazine, Kenneth Allen, has an article in your upcoming issue. It's called Wachovia, We Miss You Already. And please don't let Charlotte become the next Hickory. The next Hickory? What does that mean for people outside the area?
What that means is that several years ago, the main bank of Hickory was bought by then First Union. First Union bought Wachovia, took the Wachovia name, and the economy in Hickory really struggled for a while. And it's just now, maybe, hopefully, starting to come back. Let's just hope that what has happened to other towns doesn't happen to Charlotte.
Well, and we have to say that Kenneth Allen is worried. He says no matter what, Wachovia will be a shell of its former self if there's anything left at all. And he goes on to point out that even if Wells Fargo or whoever wins the bidding war, he didn't know obviously when he wrote this, keeps the bank base here, it's going to be diminished and it'll hurt the accountants, the lawyers, the cleaning services, the restaurants, car rental firms, a barber in the Wachovia complex whose business is made up almost entirely of Wachovia executives, that there's a triple-down effect and that people should brace for that.
You've pinpointed the biggest fear here is that of the job losses that will be here, will it be those with salaries in the six and perhaps seven figures? And if so, certainly there's a service economy built up around that. Then again, you know, if those Wachovia jobs are lost, there's enough going on in Charlotte that other companies whether there are companies that are here now or companies that may come here, will eventually fill that gap.
Right. Well, but he points out that he's worried about a balance of power, that there will be a business there, but it won't be the power base the way Wachovia was, the home of Wachovia. And with that sort of tension off one end of Tryon Street, Bank of America at the other end of Tryon Street may not have the same motivation to be so involved in Charlotte. If Wells Fargo isn't as involved as Wachovia was, it isn't, after all, you know, their main headquarters, that Bank of America may back off as well.
The competitive aspect between the two banks has really made a lot happen downtown especially. So I think there is a fear that, you know, without Wachovia there to challenge Bank of America, whether it's in philanthropy or whether it's just in growth and development, that the natural human tendency would be just to relax a little bit.
Is there a little bit too, Richard, of a feeling of, gee, this might have been what it was like when other cities lost their banks, when, as you said, Bank of America and Wachovia were buying them up?
There is. There's a little bit of probably what goes around comes around. Because certainly, our banks have grown by acquisition. So now it's happening to us a little bit. We're a little bigger than a lot of those towns that we acquired banks. And I say we, meaning the two banks. I think that speaks to how closely identified the banks are with Charlotte. And when people say we, they mean Charlotte or the banks. But there's a little bit of that.
Remind us the roles, the two banks, Bank of America and now Wachovia / Wells Fargo, but remind us in the past the roles that Wachovia and Bank of America played in the city. I mean, we talked about how there was a rivalry. The New York Times detailed some of the things that happened. One bank would build a building, the other bank would build a bigger building. Remind us of some of the ways that the banks helped the city.
It goes back to when they were known as Nations Bank and First Union. And Nations Bank led by Hugh McCall, First Union led by Ed Crutchfield. When the interstate banking laws became relaxed, they went on buying sprees. And that's when the competition really began as to sort of who could grow the fastest. And eventually First Union purchased Wachovia out of Winston-Salem. Nations Bank purchased Bank America out of, ironically, San Francisco, became Bank of America. And even since then, you're right, it's been the north end of downtown has always been Bank of America territory. The south end of downtown has been Wachovia territory. You know, when one bank announces a skyscraper, you can count that within 6 months the other bank will announce one soon. Bank of America has always been a huge supporter of the arts, Wachovia, the United Way. It has been a competition.
It was sort of a friendly competition, though. I mean, we're reading that Bank of America employees were not gleeful about Wachovia's troubles. I mean, these are people who interact in a social way as well.
Absolutely. This is a big city, but it has a small town feel. So when one bank is in pain, we all feel it.
We understand the banks helped the city put money into sports facilities, infrastructure improvements, and that helped the city become a magnet for, young, educated professionals. I mean, Charlotte really is gleaming right now. Is there concern that even though, and maybe some relief that it was Wells Fargo that made the merger with Wachovia, is there concern overall, given the state of banking in general, of the investment world in general, that Charlotte may be in for some tough times?
There's going to be a short-term hit. There's no doubt about that. And there's a lot of people that are sort of just waiting to see what's going to happen, not making hiring decisions and not making philanthropic decisions. But the traits of Charlotte that have attracted business over the years haven't changed. You know, it's the weather, the people here, the cost of living. Those things aren't going to change. So I really think that in 2 to 3 years, we'll be back on the positive track.
Well, I think it's you that wrote, when all else fails, Charlotte will always have college basketball. and that's something people really turn to.
Well, I guess I was speaking as much of myself as anything. College basketball season is just around the corner, and we can lose ourselves in the competitive exploits of young athletes. Davidson College is right down the road here, has one of the game's best players in Stephen Curry. And maybe we'll just focus on that for the next few months.
Richard Thurman, editor of Charlotte Magazine in Charlotte, North Carolina. Richard, thanks for speaking with us, and best to you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yes, when the going gets tough, the tough turn to sports. Ugh, but here in Boston, we have our Red Sox. Ugh. Is there some maybe unexpected way the financial situation is affecting your community? We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. You can always give us a call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. You're listening to Here and Now. Over the weekend, the New York Times quoted voters in Ohio saying they were wary of a black president, even though they felt Barack Obama might be better for them economically. What would Tim and Tom have done with that information? Tim Reed was a marketing man for DuPont from Norfolk, Virginia. Tom Dreesen was a salesman for Columbus Mutual Life Insurance from Harvey, Illinois, when they met at a J.C.'s meeting in the 70s and formed the first and only black and white comedy act. Both had been raised in poverty, both witnessed domestic violence. Tim was black, Tom was white. Here, Tim tries to teach Tom how to act like a black man.
Pretend this is a black neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
Right, now I'm standing on the corner.
Uh-huh.
You pretend you're another black man. Walk up to me and start a conversation. Right, now I'm standing on the corner with some more black people, selling radios and things. Now you come up.
Hey, baby. Now, look here, Leroy. Do the bus stop here. What do you think this is, Amos and Andy? Do the bus stop here.
You're going to die of natural causes.
What you mean?
Some dude in the natural going to kill you.
As Tim and Tom, they got a lot of laughs and got into some tough situations, but never made it as big as they did when they each went solo. Tim as an actor, producer, director, starring on WKRP in Cincinnati in Frank's Place. Tom as Frank Sinatra's opening act for 14 years. Now, Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white, written with Ron Rappaport, tells their story. And Tim and Tom join us in the studio. Welcome.
Hello, hello.
Thank you.
Didn't make it big, Tom, but you opened for Bread. I mean, come on.
We opened for a lot of acts, as Tim and Tom, you know, a lot of great acts out there, a lot of acts in the jazz world, Count Basie and Lionel Hampton.
Lightnin' Hopkins.
Yeah.
Lightnin' Hopkins.
So
yeah.
Maybe not as big as when you went on to be solo acts, but it was pretty darn big, although never enough money. Let's just put it in context for people. We can see by the pictures, yes, there were very bad leisure suits.
But everyone wore them.
Everyone wore those. And had anyone ever before Tim Reed joked about race relations?
People had joked about it. Godfrey Cambridge, Dick Gregory, they were joking about
but
it,
not,
but not black and white.
And this was, as you said, in the 70s, which were really just an extension of the 60s. We were very close to some, you know, terrible news headlines. And you, Tim Reed, for instance, you're working once in Atlanta. You go to a shopping district there, and you see a shop where Lester Maddox was selling racist memorabilia.
An axe handle. We arrived in New Orleans the day that Wallace was shot, and we stayed in a place that I think it was called the Jefferson Davis Hotel, and the Confederate flag behind the desk, and we go in to check in to get one room because that's all we could afford. And I was just praying, please don't let it be a black man, you know, because I know I've got trouble. And we actually did have trouble the first night there. Someone attacked Tom from the stage.
And Tom, talk about what it was like. Well, you know, there was trouble when the room was all white, trouble when the room was all black. For you, Tom Dreesen, the white half of the team, what was it like when the room was all black?
If there was a black guy who didn't like white people, you know, hated them with a passion, he wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Tim for being with me. Vice versa, if there was a redneck who hated black folks, he wasn't mad at Tim. He was mad at me for being with Tim.
Right.
So we learned how to play the room. You know.
Well, let's give an example. Like, there's this one time you walk to the edge and you're looking out and it's an all-black audience. And you say to Tim, not a lot of my people here. We have to be funny. And Tim, you say?
What do you mean, we, white man? You
put him funny.
Of course, that's the old Tonto joke.
Yeah. And there's another time... Now, we have to be careful, I think, here with our words. But another time, Tom, when a black man started yelling at you, you know, call Tim what you would normally call him. Honky.
Well, what he said was, you know, hey, white boy, I'm talking to you, honky. I'm talking to you, white boy. And it stopped the audience.
Right.
And he said, why don't you call him an N-word?
you know, because that's what you'd call them in Mississippi. And without thinking, I said, I've called them an N-word, and, you know, in Chicago. Now, there was a pause. Our hearts stopped. And then the room erupted in the laughter, and they pounded the tables and screamed. Because, and even the guy who said it, he pointed at me like, that's real, brother. Because had I done one of those, oh, no, sir, I've never used that word, whatever, then it wouldn't have been real. It just was instinctive. It was one of those
things. But there, what you just said when you asked the question, that word, you know, the political correctness of today's humor for all words, not just that word, has gotten so that there's no way that we could do what we did then.
We've been speaking with Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen about their 70s comedy act, the first and only black and white comedy team. Let's listen to more of their bit when Tim tried to teach Tom to walk and talk like a black man.
Check me out now. Remember, we brothers.
We brothers.
In the ghetto.
In the ghetto.
All right. Hey, what's happening, Jive? My main man. Say, look here, baby, this way I catch Big Mac, I got to ease uptown, get me some new rags, you know, a couple fronts, pair of gaiters, go check them traps, do a little night crawling through the hood.
That's out of sight, man. I didn't know you spoke a foreign language.
That's ghetto talk, man. That's the way you talk in the hood.
In the hood?
The neighborhood. Just walk up here and repeat what I just said. Hey, baby.
Look here, man. That's where I catch Big Rag. I got to slide uptown and buy a bus. There's some alligators stuck in my traps. I'm going to go crawl through the night with a hood on.
No, Tom. Don't you ever crawl through a black neighborhood with a hood on. Let's get out of here.
Eventually, Tim and Tom broke up. Both men hit hard times. Tim quit show business for a while, and Tom struggled to keep his comedy career alive. Then each became stars in their own right. They are together again in their new book, Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White. And Tim, before the break, you were talking about how difficult it would be for anyone to do today what you and Tom did back in the 70s because of political correctness. So what do you think has happened to race discussion today?
It's become a situation where the elephant in the room is ignored. And yet we have progressed so far racially as a people, but we won't discuss it. So consequently, there's no discourse. Tom and I were having discourse about race back in the early 70s when there was so much tension going on.
But not getting paid a lot to do it. I mean, this was rough on both of you. And ultimately, the duo breaks up. Why, by the way, write about it now?
That was Tom's idea. He pestered me for at least 10 years. Let's do this. And I said, no one cared then. They don't care now. And he said, no, let's do this. And finally, his passion won me over, and we did it.
And he also inspired you at another time. As you said, you'd quit. But Tom, after real rough go, you were sleeping in cars. And then you got a break?
Yeah, the Tonight Show. In those days, you got to remember, in 1975, wherever you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. Well, the next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah? You ever been on Johnny Carson? And if you hadn't been, in the eyes of America, you might want to be a comedian, but you weren't one now. Mm-hmm. So that was the ultimate test. I struggled after the team broke up. I lived in an old Nash Rambler, an abandoned car. I hitchhiked up and down Sunset Boulevard, begging to work for free at the comedy store. I finally got the Tonight Show to come and see me, and then I finally got the show, and I got bumped four times. But that night that I got on was the hottest night I ever had in my career on that show. That night turned it for me, and I've never stopped working. But the irony, and it's in the book, is while I was on the Tonight Show scoring, Tim Reed was watching me.
Right, and what did his getting on that Tonight Show gig, what did that do for you, Tim Reed?
Well, I was in an equally bad financial situation. I had separated from my wife, and my kids were in another state, and I wasn't doing well. I hadn't worked in quite some time, and I watched him, and two things happened to me. I had two feelings. One was I was very happy for him, and the other was I was very sad for myself. I'm thinking, I should be up there too, not in place of him.
Right.
A lot of people go, that should be me. I never thought it should be me, but I should be there too. That kicked me in the head, and I says, I got to get up and make a decision here. Do I go back and do whatever it is that fate will take me, or do I fight this hard and move forward? And I chose to move forward.
And boy, did you ever. WKRP in Cincinnati. And in fact, Tim, everybody remembers, played DJ Venus Flytrap, a black DJ on a Cincinnati radio station. And Tom, you had a guest shot. Let's listen. This is Tom Dreesen as a reporter working to interview Venus Flytrap. Let's listen to a little of that exchange.
I didn't know you'd be white.
I thought this was a black station.
It's a white station.
I'm white. My magazine's black.
I'm black.
We're an equal opportunity employer.
Same here.
We're pretty militant about it, too.
Me, too.
Well, good. Let's talk.
About what?
How about race?
I don't think that much about it.
Me neither.
Have a seat.
Thank you.
How was that, Tim Reed, for you to have this place to sort of, in a very different way, continue the national dialogue you guys started about race?
It gave us an opportunity to sort of relive those moments on a higher plane, I might add. If you listen to the music back there, we were playing Bob Marley, and one of the things that we chose that particular song for some of the message in it, but I was the first DJ, fictitious DJ, I might add, to play Bob Marley in America on a consistent level. And he always sent a message to me that he really appreciated that. So we took some chances with the show because, again, he was playing the only white man in an all-black situation. And, of course, my character was the only black man in an all-white situation. There was the dichotomy. Again, race was the vehicle. The joke was the irony. And that's what our material was about.
Yeah.
There's so much joy in that book and so much motivation in that book, as well as there's tears and there's heartache.
Well, the joy is really something. Considering we really haven't gotten into the first third of the book, really, which is the lives you guys lived when you were coming up, two completely different places, but the extreme poverty, the family despair, the lack of relationship with a father, in your case, Tom, not even knowing that your uncle was your father.
Yeah, I had a father, but I find out later on that my biological father happened to be my uncle, who I emulated.
Is that what enabled you sociologists for decades have said, if only poor white America and poor black America could understand they have more in common than not. Is that what enabled you to forge the friendship you did?
Race was never an issue with us. We fought and argued about things on an equal level. Mm-hmm. We split every dollar on an equal level. I think that what made that possible may have been how we were brought up. When you look at our past, I mean, I didn't know who my father was till I was 9. I was an only child, but in a dysfunctional situation. And the kind of poverty that his was worse. He's probably...
Tom, yours was worse.
He's like Charles Dickens. I mean,
right. Yours was worse. The rats and the...
He was much worse. But nonetheless, I think when we came together, there was an instinctive feeling of that we were both beyond that initial confusion because we had suffered so much. I guess maybe that's what we felt.
Something happens when you've gone through hardships together that you're going to get each other out of here. And Tim and I went through crisis from day one. I mean, the fourth time on stage, a guy put a lit cigarette out in Tim's face, and then he tried to beat me half to death. You know, we get in the car that night, and both of us battered and wounded, and Tim looked at me and he said, "Hey, welcome to show business." So we had that sort of, we're going to stick this thing out. Again, we were doing a discourse in those days, as Senator Obama and John McCain have both pointed out, we need more discourse among the races. Now, that was 35 years ago. Tim and I were the discourse. You know, black people would say to me, "Do all white people think like this?" And they'd give some question. And white people say, "Do you think all black people think that way?" They wouldn't have the discourse with each other. Tim and I were having that on stage. And not all of our routines about race, but the fact that a black guy and a white guy would go on stage and have a lot of fun together. If they're talking about eating hamburgers, didn't matter. We were the discourse they weren't having. And that's why the book has taken off so well, because I think people, 35 years later, they're still asking for that discourse.
Right, asking someone else to tell them what
someone
other
else.
People
yes.
think.
Yes, yeah, someone right. else. They still don't want to have it.
By the way, Tim Reed, I just want to ask, you still married to Daphne Maxwell Reed?
25 years, December.
And what is she up to?
She's doing well. She's actually going back. She's going back to Northwestern for the first time to be recognized as the first black homecoming queen, because they didn't recognize her back in 67 or whatever it was she was.
When she was actually voted,
but
they didn't give it to her.
She never made the yearbook, and they never mentioned her, and they avoided the issue, and... But she's going back. The new president said, "You know what? We have to right this wrong." So she's going back. She was able to forgive to go back because she was really frustrated by it.
So you're both kind of going through a reexamination of a certain time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, for people who think it's all over, it ain't over.
Well, it wasn't long ago. I mean, we're not talking many years ago.
That's right.
We need to remember that so that we can move forward with where we are now.
Well, the book is Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White by Tim Reed, Tom Dreesen, written with Ron Rappaport. Tim Reed and Tom Dreesen, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us
Thank
about
you.
It.
Thank you.
Thank you.